Open up to Nehemiah chapter 13. If you're not sure where Nehemiah is, it's just a little to the left of the center of the Bible, just before Psalms, Job, and Esther. Today is the second last message in this series of Nehemiah, and actually the second of a three-part mini-series that comes at the end of Nehemiah. So just to bring you up to speed on where we've come here, Nehemiah was King Artaxerxes' wine taster in roughly 400 BC, a long time ago. At this time, Israel has just spent 70 years in Babylonian captivity because of their disobedience to God's law. So way back in Deuteronomy, this is why they ended up back in Babylon. It's because of Deuteronomy. Just before Moses died, he reminded the people of what it meant to live their lives to God's glory, to his pleasure. And in chapter 28, so almost at the end of Deuteronomy, we get this famous list of blessings and curses. And they follow either a life lived with or separated from God. And so Moses says, if you obey the Lord your God, you'll be blessed in the city, blessed in the country. The fruit of your womb will be blessed. The crops of your land and the young of your livestock, your basket, your kneading trough will be blessed. You'll be blessed when you come in. You'll be blessed when you go out. And it just goes on and on like this. God says, joy is yours when you live your life in line with my will. Then it switches gears. It says, however, if you don't obey the Lord your God and don't follow all his commands, all these curses will come on you and overtake you. You'll be cursed in the city, cursed in the country. Your basket, your kneading trough will be cursed. The Lord will cause you to be defeated before your enemies. Here's the part where we get to Babylon, right? Your sons and daughters will be given into another nation. You'll wear out your eyes watching for them day after day, powerless to lift a hand. The Lord will drive you and the king you set over you to a nation unknown to you or your ancestors. All these curses will come on you. They'll pursue you and overtake you until you're destroyed because you did not obey the Lord your God and observe his commandments or decrees. And so Israel lived under God's rule of law. And this stipulated that blessing resided with obedience, and while the consequences of disobedience would ultimately result in being expelled from the promised land. And this was the reality that they were living under. So they had disobeyed the law, and now they were suffering the consequences. But now, that punishment is up, and under King Artaxerxes, God's giving them another chance. Aren't you glad that we worship a God of another chances? You need that? So God spoke to Artaxerxes. He instructed him to let the people return to Jerusalem, to rebuild their city, to restart their religious ritual. And Nehemiah gets to play a huge role in this. So back in chapter 1, we watched Nehemiah foster God's heart within himself. So he cares for people who are poor and oppressed, not really like him in a lot of ways. And so he's wealthy. He's 1,200 kilometers away, and yet when Nehemiah learns of the plight of those in Jerusalem, he breaks down and he weeps and he fasts. And we said, well, there's a lot in the story that's just descriptive. This describes a setting that Nehemiah finds himself in, but there's other things that are prescriptive, and fostering this kind of heart is prescriptive for us. So if we're going to image Christ, this is for us today then, we need to develop a heart for the hurting. We need to care about people who aren't like us, maybe don't look like us. And when we do this, we image God. Another thing we saw that was prescriptive for us came when Nehemiah prayed and God opened his eyes. And this is probably my favorite thing about the Nehemiah story. So while there's no miracles, I mean, the amazing miracles of the Bible are awesome. I'm just thinking of like the Red Sea, for example. It's something that when you see this, everybody who's there has to acknowledge, there's something going on. This is probably a miracle. But there's nothing like that that goes on in Nehemiah. Yet over and over again, we see that Nehemiah is able to perceive God's involvement in his situation. And so he says things like this, because the gracious hand of my God was on me, the king granted my request. Nehemiah just asks for stuff. The king says, sure. And Nehemiah's like, that's God, right? It's a miracle. But it's one that could be missed if he didn't have eyes to see it. We need to foster these kind of eyes. This doesn't just happen by default. We miss these kind of things unless we've developed these kind of eyes. So the book starts off with a lot of success. But then reality starts setting in. Nehemiah and the Jews began facing several different forms of opposition as they set out to put the vision for rebuilding Jerusalem into action. And some of this opposition came from outside the faith community. And other opposition came from inside. These are people who are afraid about what might happen when the changes take place. And again, we said, you know, this isn't just for Nehemiah, this is for us. And so as Fort George prepares to put the values that God has directed us towards into action, we need to be aware that we're going to face opposition. Right? Jesus promises that if we're living for him, we're going to face opposition. So we shouldn't be surprised then if, you know, hypothetically over the next couple years, we're putting some of these plans that we're going to come up with today after at lunchtime, we're putting some of these plans into action, and then all of a sudden we start facing opposition from outside. And this is what happened to Trinity Western, right? They wanted to build a law school. All of a sudden they get all this opposition. Same things happened recently with Nest Lake Bible Camp. It can happen to us. So we shouldn't actually be surprised when opposition comes at us from outside. But we also shouldn't be surprised when people arise among us and resist. This kind of opposition can be tricky because it comes from godly people. These are people who want to see the kingdom grow, but they're nervous and they're afraid. So the Jews who were living near Nehemiah, these are religious Jews. They love the same God Nehemiah loves. They're living near Nehemiah and they're telling him over and over again. Actually, Nehemiah says, they told me 10 times, all right? If you rebuild the walls, if you do this vision, our enemies are going to come and attack us. Now, it was a possibility. There was a chance. Sanballat could have attacked, but he didn't. And so the fears these Jews had was of something that might happen in the future. But fear like this never comes from God. Friends, Satan is the author of the fear of the unknown. That's his domain. And so when opposition like this arises inside the camp, we need to be encouraging our brothers and sisters. You're going to hear this, all right? So people here, we're going to be afraid of what might happen. But when you hear this, we need to encourage our brothers and sisters to have faith and to put the future in God's hands. We never know what will happen. But that doesn't change what we must do. So second, we need to move forward in spite of the unknown. Friends, the reality is that God isn't disappointed when we set out to grow his kingdom and then make mistakes in the process. He's not disappointed. He's not fazed by that. The only servants God opposes are those who do nothing with what he's given them. So we must put the resources and talent he's put at our disposal to work. And I want to encourage you again to come out to be part of this town hall afterwards. Participate in this. We need your help. In the end of Nehemiah, he'd spent 12 years rebuilding and reforming Jerusalem. And after this, he returns to Artaxerxes, did a bit more wine tasting. But then in chapter 13, we get this epilogue. And Nehemiah is granted permission to head back to Jerusalem. But when he arrives, he finds out that without the constant vigilance of leadership, God's people have quickly shifted their attention away from the vertical, from living their lives into God's glory and onto the horizontal, just the things of daily life. And when this happened, there's just rapid digression into some of the old sins that they'd been in before. And so last week, we touched on the fact that if you're a person, anybody a person here? All right. If you're a person, then your default is to revert to living your life in a way that doesn't please God. That's the default for you. So it doesn't matter how long you've climbed towards him. There's no such thing as coasting when it comes to pursuing Christ-likeness. As soon as vigilance stops, movement away from God begins. And so last week we looked at how God's people had used their resources in a way that didn't honor God. This took the form of allowing God's enemy, Tobiah, to take up residence in the temple, actually in a room dedicated to collecting the offerings of the people. Tobiah just moves in. He's the enemy. And what resulted was with Tobiah in the temple, the people actually were unable to give to God. Now, some of this is descriptive, right? There's no temple today, and so the way and the reasons for giving to God are different. But there's a principle here that's still relevant to us. So we saw how Stats Canada says, 93% of regular church attending people give money to charity in Canada. That's great. But it also says in 2010 that the average amount given was $1,004. And so if you compare that with the average annual household income of $76,000, that means on average, wealthy church attending Christians, that's who it's talking about, spend over 98% of our income on ourselves and our country, if you include taxes, and you probably have to in Canada. We only give away a shocking 1.3%. It's phenomenal. That's us we're talking about. And the reason for our stinginess with God is a bit complicated. I think there's lots of factors. But one factor in the equation is that we simply can't afford to give away more. That's because we've let Tobiah into the temple. So we've spent ourselves into the hole so far that there literally isn't any room in the average North American budget to give any more away. And so, like in Nehemiah's day, God's people have failed to use God's resources to build God's kingdom. And the answer, I think, to this is we need to kick Tobiah out of the temple. And we need to it's not that we need to make more money, right? I mean, the fact is we've got tons of money. You've got tons of money, right? Not a lot of nods there, all right? The reality is that we need to spend less of our money on ourselves, and thereby freeing up resources that we can use to increase God's glory and expand his kingdom. Use God's money to honor God. Second issue, though, that God's people had slumped back into while Nehemiah was gone was that they were failing to use the time God had allotted them to build God's kingdom. And so let's pick it up now again in Nehemiah chapter 13, starting in verse 15. In those days, I saw the people in Judah treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in grain and loading it on donkeys together with wine, grapes, figs, and all other kinds of loads. And they were bringing all this into Jerusalem on the Sabbath. Therefore, I warned them against selling food on that day. People from Tyre, so these are not Jewish people, not part of the religious community, but they lived in Jerusalem, were bringing in fish and all kinds of merchandise and selling them in Jerusalem on the Sabbath to the people of Judah. I rebuked the nobles of Judah and said to them, "What is this wicked thing you're doing, desecrating the Sabbath day? Didn't your ancestors do the same thing so that our God brought all this calamity on us and on this city?" Remember Deuteronomy, he's saying? "Now you're stirring up more wrath against Israel by desecrating the Sabbath." When evening shadows fell on the gates of Jerusalem before the Sabbath, I ordered the doors to be shut and not opened until the Sabbath was over. I stationed some of my own men at the gates so that no load could be brought in on the Sabbath day. Once or twice, the merchants and sellers of all kinds of goods spent the night outside Jerusalem. But I warned them and said, "Why do you spend the night by the wall? If you do this again, I'll arrest you." From that time on, they no longer came on the Sabbath. Then I commanded the Levites to purify themselves and go and guard the gates in order to keep the Sabbath day holy. Remember me for this also, my God, and show mercy to me according to your great love. Now, under the old covenant, God's people were required to rest one day in seven. So they're to cease from all their labor. They're to reorient their lives around God. And so Nehemiah locks the gates of the city to bring the people back to this. Now, why was Sabbath such a big deal to Nehemiah? Well, the reason that it was such a big deal to Nehemiah is that it was such a big deal to God. But why was it a big deal to God? Well, the reason it was a big deal to God was that he knew it was the best thing for his people. So God gave the people two reasons for why they were to obey the Sabbath. First, in Exodus 20, we read this: remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. This is out of the Ten Commandments. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that's in them. But he, God, rested on the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. So God's people were to rest one day in seven as a way of imaging their creator, their God, who'd done the same. That's why you do this. I did this, you did this. Now, obviously God didn't need to rest on the Sabbath, right? He's not tired. He's not burnt out. And yet he rests. Well, he rested because he didn't need to keep on striving. He wants to give us an example that even I don't need to keep on working. And so he enabled his people then to image him because he knew that this would be best for us. And so he gives the Jews the Sabbath so they can image their creator to their own benefit. Friends, looking like God always brings people joy. And that's the first reason they were to rest on the Sabbath. Second reason God gave the Jews for obeying the Sabbath is found in Deuteronomy. Also the Ten Commandments, we read this: observe the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt and that the Lord your God brought you out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God has commanded you to observe the Sabbath day. So here, God's people are to rest one day in seven as a way of remembering that their salvation came not through their own effort, but through the effort of God. So it wasn't their hard work that delivered them from Egypt, right? It was Yahweh. He's the Savior. He delivered them. And so they would stop working one day in seven in order to remind themselves that God was God. But when Nehemiah returned, the people aren't honoring the Sabbath. They're treading wine presses. They're bringing in grain. They're conducting business. And so Nehemiah locks the gates. He forces them, actually, to obey this, to image God, which is to their joy, and to remember that it's Yahweh's work, not their own work, by which they're saved. Now, throughout this series, we've been looking at the descriptive and prescriptive elements of the story of Nehemiah. If you've been with us, that should sound really, really familiar. And so some things just describe the world that Nehemiah is living in. They're not for us, just sets up the story. And other things prescribe the way we're to live if we're going to please God. And we need to tackle the topic of Sabbath with the same understanding. So we need to know what elements of it are descriptive and what elements are prescriptive for us. And Jesus, I think, invites and really brings this question to the forefront in the Sermon on the Mount. There he says, don't think that I've come to abolish the law or the prophets. I haven't come to abolish them. And then he says this, but to fulfill them. But this is difficult. What this question of what to fulfill them means is a little difficult to nail down. We're going to work on that today. Now, as we get into this and we start talking about Sabbath, I need to say one aspect of Sabbath that I'm not going to touch is the whole Saturday or Sunday debate, okay? So all I'll say is that the early church shifted their Sabbath to the first day of the week in honor of Jesus' resurrection. This happened incredibly early, within the first 20 years, and Jesus' resurrection was on a Sunday. And so whenever I talk about Sabbath, just hear Sunday. But there's another debate about Sabbath, and it's more important than that one, and it's where we're going to spend our time today. And so there's three perspectives within the Christian tradition as to what Jesus meant when he said he fulfilled the law. And this applies to Sabbath particularly. But as some believe, Jesus' fulfillment of the law is restricted to the political rules, right? So that's like Israel as a nation, and the temple rules about sacrifices. So Jesus' fulfillment restricted to those areas. We're not in Israel, right? There is no temple. And so Jesus' fulfillment fulfills those rules. Those rules no longer apply. But this camp of people believes that the rest of the Old Testament, 613 laws, do apply still. And so Sabbath and dietary laws and even clothing rules are morally binding to this group of people. A second group of Christians believe that Jesus' fulfillment of law applies to all the laws of the Old Testament except God's moral code in the Ten Commandments. So the Ten Commandments still apply, but all the rest of the laws don't. Those have been fulfilled. And finally, other Christians believe that Jesus' fulfillment of the law applies to all the law of the Old Testament. So even the Ten Commandments do not hold moral obligation over Christians like they did over the Jews. Three camps. If you go on the internet, you can find a lengthy argument in favor and in opposition to all three of these positions. I'm only going to talk about the one that the majority of the evangelical world embraces, and that is, which seems to do the best job of holding the entire biblical record together, and that is that when Jesus fulfilled the law and the prophets, that included everything in the Old Testament, including the Ten Commandments. Christians are no longer bound by any of the Old Testament rules. Now, as I say this, I want to stop right there and I want to tell you what I'm not saying. Okay, so here's what I'm not saying. I'm not saying that we throw out the Old Testament or the Ten Commandments. I mean, we've just spent 9 weeks looking at Nehemiah. If I was interested in throwing out the Old Testament, we wouldn't have done that, okay? In a little bit, I'm going to tell you how we end up keeping all the Ten Commandments as a byproduct of our devotion. We'll get there. We're not there right now. Here's what I am saying. When Christians read the Old Testament law, we need to read it in light of the New Testament. When we read the Old Testament, we need to read it in light of the New Testament. So this means we need to find the prescriptive elements, all right? So those things that apply to us, and we need to extract them from within the descriptive story of the Old Testament. And we've been talking about that this whole series. And the way we do this is by lining the Old Testament up with the New Testament revelation. Theologians call this progressive revelation. All right? What this means is you get the Old Testament revelation first, and then later you get the New Testament revelation, and the New Testament is a progress over the Old Testament. So you have to read them in that order, all right? So the New Testament takes precedent. So here's what we do. When we're reading the Old Testament, you want to find out what's prescriptive. When there's something in the Old Testament that lines up with what the New Testament says, that's prescriptive for us, obviously. Right? It's saying the same thing. But where there are differences, where there's changes from Old Testament to New Testament, the New Testament always trumps the Old Testament. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to use that word anymore. But that's the idea of progressive revelation. And so the New Testament tells us that we're under a new law. This is the language it uses. And it's the law of love. It's the law of the Spirit. It's the law of grace. There's all sorts of ways of referring to this new law. Corinthians 11, Jesus said, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. Right? So this new covenant, this is a way of talking about this new law. And so Paul, then, speaking to the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians 3, says this, so he's talking to a group of Christians, you show that you're a letter from Christ. So, like, in other words, they can look at these people and, like, read Jesus from these people, all right? Written not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living God. Not on tablets of stone, that should raise some pictures in your mind, but on tablets of human hearts. God has made us, he's talking about himself and a couple others, competent as ministers of a new covenant. Not of the letter, but of the Spirit. For the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. In this text, and actually if you're interested in this topic, read the whole chapter, 2 Corinthians 3, Paul compares and contrasts the old covenant with the new covenant. He says, so this old came on tablets of stone. This is an obvious reference to the Ten Commandments. While the new comes not by a letter of the law, but by the Spirit who gives life. And the old law is obeyed by doing every little thing that's written down. But the new law doesn't work like that. It's obeyed by having God's Spirit living inside of us and directing us to live in a way that pleases God. That new law works differently. So again, without getting into this debate in any depth, The majority of the evangelical community, and I would lump myself here, believes that the entirety of the Old Testament, the entirety of the law, holds no authority over the church, over Christ, or Christ's people after his fulfillment of it. So this is what this means. We don't please God. We don't obtain favor from him by living our lives under that law. Those days are gone. Rather, and this is my thesis for today, Christians love God and their neighbors and themselves with God's love for God's pleasure. This is how we please God and their own joy. So Christians love God and their neighbors and themselves with God's love for God's pleasure and their own joy. And I'm taking this, basing it largely off the way that Jesus reinterprets the law for the Pharisees. So Pharisees ask, you know, what's the greatest commandment in the law? And Jesus responds, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. It's the first and greatest commandment. Second's like it, love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. So when Jesus is telling us this, he's telling us how we're to live now. And he doesn't say, you know, the most important commandments are the 10. He says everything in the law hangs on or it's built on this foundation of loving God and loving your neighbor as yourself. Now, obviously, if you are loving God, then you aren't having any other gods before him, right? That should just totally make sense. You're not using his name in vain if you love him. If you love your neighbor, then you're not murdering them or committing adultery with their spouse, right? Obviously. But under the new law, there's even more to it than that. So in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus makes it clear that following the rules isn't the point. Rather, what's important is living your life in line with the heart of God. That's what matters. So Jesus says this, just for example, you've heard that it was said to the people long ago, you shall not murder. This is one of the Ten Commandments, right? Anyone who murders will be subject to the judgment. But I tell you, this is this new law, all right? Anyone who's angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. So obedience to Jesus' law, Jesus' new law, doesn't mean that we don't do what the old law stipulates. In fact, God's heart for us goes well beyond what the letter of the law ever stipulated. So that's the law or the Ten Commandments in general. Right? They're fulfilled. There's just something more. But even with this understanding, that fourth commandment, honor the Sabbath and keep it holy, poses some trouble for us. And that's because I think that keeping the Sabbath has little to do with loving our neighbor. I mean, if I keep the Sabbath, do you feel loved? Not really. But it also doesn't really have anything to do with loving God. I mean, how is God loved when I don't work? Fact is, I think that we don't really know what to do with the Sabbath. And so actually Mark Buchanan mentioned this at Cultivate this last weekend. The Sabbath has just become one of those commands that we disregard. I mean, we don't make idols. At least we try not to. We avoid murdering each other most of the time. But many of us just don't even think about the Sabbath. We don't honor the Sabbath. And we don't do this because we don't understand the heart of God behind it. We just don't know what we're supposed to do with it in light of Jesus. So, how are we supposed to understand the Sabbath in light of Jesus? Two things. First, we have to affirm that none of the Old Testament law is morally binding over us. None of it, all right? We're under the law of grace through Christ and the Spirit. That means the way we please God has nothing to do with following the rules, everything to do with reflecting God's heart of love. That's what it's about. We get that. We get that we're to love God and love our neighbors as ourselves. But the problem is that we've seen this really to be two commands, but there's a hint of a third here as well. So we're to love God with God's love. This is important. Really, the only kind of love worthy of God, the only love that he accepts from us is a kind that comes first from him by grace through the Spirit, right? That's what we return to him. So we love God with God's love. Second, we're to love our neighbors, not just with our own love, but actually with God's love. We're to image God to them. We're to love them with the love that Christ pours into us. But third, we're to love our neighbors as ourselves, which means we need to love ourselves with God's love. And the command that the Sabbath speaks to. So Jesus said this: Sabbath was made to meet the needs of people, not people to meet the requirements of Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord even over the Sabbath. Jesus is Lord of the Sabbath. He loved Sabbath. He used it to bring abundant life and salvation to people all the time. Actually, most of the miracles in the Gospels happened on the Sabbath. Almost all of them. Jesus did this to convey the point that the Sabbath is for people. God is for people. He's for you. It's not about keeping the rules. It's about receiving the gift of abundant life from God. And the Sabbath, then, is the way we receive God's love. As such, while the rule is obsolete, the heart behind the Old Testament Sabbath is still prescriptive. So, back in Exodus and Deuteronomy, when God tells the people why they're to keep the Sabbath, it's not for God. It's not to love God. It's for them. God knew that if the people would work perpetually, they'd lose sight of who he was and who he'd made them to be. And so he gives them the gift of Sabbath so that they can experience the joy that comes from imaging him. And also so that they can remember that it's his work. It's not their own. That's the source of their deliverance and bondage. God gave them Sabbath as a gift of grace. It was for them. Now, understood this way, the Sabbath then has the same prescriptive value for us as the other nine commands. So we're not obliged to keep any of them to earn God's favor. You got to say that really clearly. But because we love God with the love Jesus has put in our hearts, we find ourselves not having any other gods or making idols or using his name in vain. We just find ourselves doing that. It's the byproduct of our devotion. Similarly, because we love our neighbors, we don't steal, we don't covet their stuff or bear false testimony against them. And we do this again, not because we're following the law. Nobody did this because, oh, make sure I got that Ten Commandments down. We do it because of this love that Jesus has put in us for them. We love our neighbors with the love of Christ. But in the same way then, because we love ourselves with Christ's love, and I want to say this another way, you could say it, because we've received Christ's love for us, that's the same as loving yourself with Christ's love. We've received Christ's love for us. The byproduct is living our life in a way that honors ourselves. Therefore, people who've been saved, who've received the love of Jesus, are people who keep the Sabbath. They don't work 7 days a week because of the rule. They don't work like this because they image the God who rests. They don't work like this to remind themselves that it's only God who saves. Their work doesn't earn anything from him, so they can stop it. The universe doesn't revolve around your work, what you're doing. You can stop. Ultimately, they don't work like this because they've received God's love and love themselves. And the result is they Sabbath to their joy. Now, practically, I think Sabbath is going to look different for different people because there's not any rules for how to apply it. But just like a Christian really wouldn't understand what it meant to love God and love people if they're asking, you know, do I really need to avoid killing people? You're not understanding something here if you're asking that. Can I worship two gods? You're just not understanding what this means. In the same way, if you're asking, do I have to keep the Sabbath? You don't understand what it means to love yourself with God's love. Friends, Sabbath is a gift from God. It's a grace. God didn't make you for Sabbath. He made the Sabbath for you. But the thought of rejecting God's gifts should make you squirm. No rules here. It's a gift. But the thought of rejecting God's gift should make you squirm. The Pharisees did this. They didn't want Jesus' salvation, and so they missed out on it. It's people who receive God's gifts like children that are saved. So brothers and sisters, there's no rule that you have to follow about what you can or can't do on the Sabbath. None. But the rules aren't the point. Stop worrying about the rules. The grace is the point. So the prescription here for us is to embrace God's gift, because that's how we please God. We please God when we take what he gives us for our own joy, his pleasure, our joy, now and for eternity. So take one day in seven. Ask yourself, what can I do today to better image God? Just dedicate a day of your week to that. What will help me remember that I'm not him, that Yahweh is God, that it's his work that saves me? Focus on that. Friends, the heart of God for your joy is that we use one day in seven to do something different. If you're in the office all week, go for a walk in creation. So come to church. Stop working to provide for yourself. Instead, trust in God, your provider. And don't do this because you have to. Do it because you get to. Your God has given you the gift of Sabbath, and it enables you to love yourself with his love. Let's pray. God, we're a funny people. Some of us struggle on one side with laziness and doing nothing, and others of us struggle on the other side with overworking and never resting. Lord, today your word is for those type A's among us who need to get stuff done. God, we want to image you. We want to look like you because we know that when we look like you, we find joy. And Lord, we want to remember that you're the Savior, that none of our work accomplishes anything eternal. It's you and your work that accomplishes what will last. We want to rest in that. So speak into our hearts, Jesus. You know what it is we need to hear. Thank you for this gift that you gave us of an end to toil. Help us to love ourselves with the love that you pour out on us. We pray this in your name. Amen.